Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuc. Sculpture Now's 2017 outdoor exhibition at the Mount in Lenox, Massachusetts is entitled Nexus. It's on view through October 31st. Sculpture Now offers free guided tours to the general public, students, and vision-impaired visitors, and their exhibitions provide opportunities for sculptors to develop their careers. This year, there are 30 works on display in and around Edith Wharton's historic home and gardens. I visited the Mount last month and spoke with three artists about their featured pieces. The first artist I spoke with was Setsko Winchester, about her Freedom from Fear Yellow Bowl project, Yellow Peril. I began by asking her to describe the work.
Basically, it's a row of yellow tea bowls. They're all hand-pinched. They're all shaped differently. They've been created in groups of families. So, you know, a group of, like a mother, father, you know, three babies, or a teenage brother or something like that. They'll all have the same foot, the bottom of the foot, and they'll have the same variation of yellow. And they're all glazed the color yellow because they symbolize 120,000 people who were incarcerated during the 40s because they were of Japanese ethnicity. So that's basically what my project is about. And I've laid the tea bowls along the forest floor at the Mount. And it sort of replicates what I did at all the 10 U.S. concentration camps where they were put in the western half of the country back in the 40s.
So let's be completely clear for non-potters. What does pinched mean?
It's when you form the clay solely with your hands. You don't use a wheel. So it's a little bit more complicated. The thinner you go, because ceramics is basically platelets that are layered on top of each other. So the more you pinch and the more you separate, it's going to fall apart. But the reason why I like to hand pinch it is because I want that feel of individuality. No two bowls feel the same. You could feel the hand of the potter. It feels more human, and the whole reason why I chose to use tea bowls is because the philosophy of tea celebrates humanity, that human beings aren't perfect. We are celebrating imperfection. It may not be uniform, it may not be perfect, but it's still beautiful. You know, just like cherry blossoms. No blossom or no snowflake. It is exactly the same, but it's still beautiful.
Tell me about the shades of yellow, the glazes. How do you mix them or choose them?
Well, I just found every single shade of yellow I can find, and I would mix them. I would keep a chart to make sure that I didn't repeat too many and, you know, change the feet. So sometimes it got a little confusing, especially once they dry, then you can't tell what color they were. So, but I could usually tell by the foot.
Have they been displayed outside every time you've displayed them?
Yes, but the original project, which is the tea bowls are part of a larger conceptual art project called the Freedom from Fear Yellow Bowl Project. And it's basically a conceptual art project. And it's based on, you know, the garden gnome?
Yes.
The whole garden gnome was originally a prank. Somebody took their neighbor's garden gnome and took it to Paris with them. And the neighbor said, "Where's my garden gnome?" And then they got a picture in the mail with their garden gnome in Paris saying, "I'm having a wonderful time." And then that became a really popular prank, and people would take, you know, like flamingo lawn furniture, things like that. And then soon it went online. And then you had things like Flat Stanley, which was a cutout paper man that people would take and you would document your journey. And eventually it turned to stuffed animals. So there's this contemporary meme of taking a mundane object and taking it somewhere fabulous and saying, "Don't you wish you were here?" So I took that meme and I twisted it a little. I took 120 ceramic tea bowls in two giant boxes and I took them to places that nobody has been to and probably would never want to go, in the hopes that I can make people curious about it, because I know that growing up in America, I didn't really learn about what happened to these people. I'd heard about it. I never actually looked into it. And about 4 or 5 years ago, I realized that I needed to go find out for myself. And so one of the things was, I'm going to visit all of them. So part of this project was to physically go there. So my husband and I took two trips across the country for a total of 16,000 miles. So this is not only a personal journey to look at what it means to be Asian in America or Asian American, also journey into history, and also a physical journey geographically to some of the most remote parts of America and desolate, barren places that you'll ever see. But it's beautiful. Some places are breathtaking, like Manzanar. It's right by Death Valley. Death Valley is stunning, but it's not any place you'd want to live. Right. Yeah.
When the bulls are in place, like they are here at the mount, they are impacted by nature. Is that part of the story, or is it just a happenstance?
Yes, part of it was that I wanted to just leave them in the forest to symbolize the fact that these people were rounded up and just stuck in the middle of nowhere and just forgotten about by history. People said, do you want to protect them? Do you want to do something with it? And I said, no, that's okay. If, you know, a squirrel runs away with one, or the worm crawls in it, or, you know, leaves fall in, you know, that's fine.
Have any been stolen by critters?
No, they haven't. Actually, there's our groundskeeper, Ross, takes a walk through the forest every day and he counts them, and they're all there. Yes, that's amazing.
Is there anything else that you want to say about the piece? Anything that I haven't asked you about that you think is important to mention?
One of the things that I hope people take away with them is that these people were innocent. There's been a lot of research done and a lot of fake news that actually came out at the time. In many ways, if you look at the history, and I was looking through the history while I was doing the research, they were often tried by the media. It was Hearst newspapers, for example, and it didn't start after Pearl Harbor. By 1941, there was over 800 pieces of legislation, federal, state, and local, targeting Asian Americans. In some ways, Pearl Harbor was the final solution in a way. And also, the other thing that a lot of people don't know is that it wasn't just in America. They rounded them up in Canada, Mexico, 30 other countries in Latin America. So it was kind of ethnic cleansing of both North and South America. And I guess I want to say that doing the research, those people were saying the same thing that I would say today. Oh, they can't take my home away. They can't put me away. I'm an American. I haven't broken the law. I haven't done anything wrong. They were saying the same thing. You can read the things they were saying, and yet it did. So in some ways, I feel like the Asian American experience is a missing link in the story of race. You can, you know, if no one hires you, you're entrepreneurial. You try to get a good education. You obey the law. You do everything right. And still, you can have everything taken away. And it didn't happen in 1860s. You know, it didn't happen 200 years ago. It happened within our lifetime. So I just hope that we can learn from this. I think that good people can also do bad things. I think sometimes people don't want to look at this because it sort of paints a unpleasant light on one of our most popular presidents. But, you know, sometimes people make bad decisions. And, you know, what people don't realize is that the Nazis learned about the concentration camps from the British Boer Wars. They used concentration camps. And the Brits won. If we're going to study what the winners do, and America won, this is going to be repeated again. We need to look at it and see if it was a good solution. If you really look into it, it wasn't. And so hopefully certain people in this administration, in fact, this president actually invoked FDR and his use of, quote, internment, saying that it was a good thing and it could be a solution for the Muslim problem. I would just like to, as a person of an ethnic group that was targeted at one time in history, in American history, we need to look at it again. because it wasn't a good solution.
Setsuko Winchester discussed her work Yellow Peril, which is on display as part of Sculpture Now's Nexus at the Mount in Lenox, Massachusetts, through the end of the month. To learn more about her Freedom from Fear Yellow Bowl project, visit yellowbowlproject.com. Next, I spoke with William Carlson about his piece, Fenestra.
My work has gone a variety of different directions, usually using natural materials, man-made materials, materials that are transparent, materials that are opaque. I usually try to involve the viewer. I try to make them a participant in the piece. So with any kind of sculpture piece, you're going to want to look at it and walk around it. But with this one, there's a sense of a barrier because of the granite. So this is about a 6-foot by 7-foot piece of granite. And it's perforated with little eyes, little ways of looking through. It's not unlike a salt shaker, if you were to be in a salt shaker.
I never have been.
No, I never have been either, but just in theory. But it also, I think, deals with the breaking down of a mass of material. So granite is, we know, solid and heavy and quite heroic. The perforations here are core-drilled holes so that you can look through this mass. You can see through it. So the title of the piece is Fenestra, and that is Latin, and that means porthole. So that's a pretty easy thing to understand. So this is a pretty, I think, audience-friendly piece. Esoteric, but not too much so. When you walk up to this, and let's walk up to this piece, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like going to the salt shaker thing, but it's also like looking at the little porthole in your apartment door when you have a knock on the door, and you want to see who's there, but they might be stepping back. So with this, each of these little eyelets, each of these little portholes, each of these little lenses allows you to see through the piece and see a different place. So if you look at these, you know we're seeing through. So we have access to the other side, even though physically we're on this side. So the piece ends up having a certain barrier quality to it. So if we walk up closer, we can look through here, and some of the lenses are pointed down, some are up. So it gives you a certain privilege to look at these different aspects of the environment. So it's a very much a site-specific type of piece. It could work for many sites, but really a site that has kind of a natural ambiance around it would be desirable.
What is the material that makes these little portholes?
These are plexiglass. Originally, they were going to be a natural glass with optical glass. But the unfortunate part is glass is fragile. So with the maintenance of this place and with everything else involved, the plexiglass was a better way to go. So these are inserted into the stone. They're secured there. And then you can really explore the piece and walk around the piece. So let's walk over on this side. So this is really quite a different look, because right now the sun is from this point, so we can still see through it. We have a little different kind of connection of dots. It's kind of like a chicken pox, you know, but the chicken pox in this case, all those little dots that are the itchy part are done with plexiglass and aluminum.
The plexiglass looks almost as though it is illuminated internally, but that's just the way that the natural light works with it.
That's right, yeah, so that it is reflective on the inside. So when I was putting the piece together, I put an aluminum tube in there, I put the plexiglass in there, and then it is suspended inside the aluminum tube, so the reflection is amplified rather than flattened, you know, as if it were against a corresponding surface. So this piece also has kind of an element of a wall or a barrier. You know, there really is one side and another, and you're not really seeing this piece as you would a lot of other sculptures, where you're going to walk around them and see the whole thing in its entirety. This is, I think, more of a participatory piece, and something that ideally is taking an outdoor opportunity like this and making it friendly to the audience and kind of friendly to whoever comes, whether they are art-informed or not. Hopefully it has some appeal on all those different levels.
I imagine people of all ages enjoying looking through the different portals and seeing what they see on the other side.
Yeah.
Where do you acquire your materials specifically? Where did you find this enormous piece of granite?
Well, it's not so enormous. There are bigger pieces, but sure. This one was at least movable. I work with a granite company that's in Blandford, Massachusetts, which is right near, right near where I live, down in South County, the Berkshires. And it is Chester Granite, and they're great people to work with. And I've dealt with them over the years. And they helped me with a piece last year that was Chesterwood, and in the past they've helped me with other projects. So they are willing to take on a project that doesn't, to them, make a lot of sense. Mm-hmm. But it's something that at least I have as a vision, and they are willing to accommodate it. Because to work a piece of granite like that, you really need the equipment. I have smaller equipment, and I can do things that become more portable. But if it's going to reach this kind of scale, then I need to have count on somebody with expertise and good equipment.
Artist William Carlson discussed his sculpture, Fenestra. Sculpture Now's 2017 exhibition, Nexus, is at the Mount through October 31st. The final artist I met with when I visited the Mount last month was David Teeple. We talked about his work, 12 Cuboid Stack.
A cuboid is almost a cube, but not quite. So there are 12 glass boxes that are 18 by 18 by 9 inches, fabricated in flat glass and assembled with silicone. They have five sides that are fully sealed, filled with water, and then another piece of glass that's floating on the top or sitting on the top, but not airtight. And then I have an aluminum structure underneath it is supporting the tanks. It's 4 inch by 4 inch by 1/8 inch wall, extruded aluminum square tubing, cut into pieces, and the piece is just stacked. And that's an important part of it, is that it is stacked. It's not, in other words, all the aluminum parts are not bolted together or welded.
I never would have guessed that. I would have absolutely assumed that they were epoxied at least.
Well, with the fact that if you do a little thinking about it and a little calculating, you realize it weighs literally a ton.
Yeah, that'll stay in place, hopefully.
It'll stay in place. It is the weight of the glass and the water that is actually keeping it held together. And there's a cantilevered arm coming off of it with eight tanks supporting two tanks. And if we go back to elemental mathematics and fulcrum points and things like that, I'm sure it's far exceeds its necessary weight capacity to hold it, but it is an interesting part about it. It is 15 feet 8 inches long, 54 inches wide, and maybe about 37 inches high or so, just to give it a sense of scale.
How did you come up with it, and how is it related to previous works?
To really answer that question, we'd have to go back to the 80s when I was living in Tucson, and I had a collector who had an Etruscan amphora in his collection that I saw all the time. And when I moved from Arizona back to Western Mass in Holyoke, which is where my studios have been for the last 20 some odd years, I was really inspired by that amphora and started to build them out of brass and copper. And at one point, I decided to do a piece that ended up being titled Vessel Paradox, where the vessel was contained by the water instead of the vessel containing the water.
So, that sounds like science fiction.
Well, it does sound like science fiction. But so I thought of what are the kinds of containers that I would have to use, that I could use to hold the water to then hold the vessel. And anything but glass, you couldn't see the vessel unless you were looking down through the water. So glass was a logical choice. And it had a brass bottom, four glass sides, open top, and this brass and copper wax lined on the inside for waterproofing vessel. Was standing upright in it. And then I started to explore all the refractions and reflections that happened, and that sparked 20 some odd years of work. This piece, the Stack series, really started in the last couple of years. They're the Stack series and Float series. So early on I was taking some of these tanks that I have, and I have 80 of this scale. Right now there are 60 that are up and around in the world in various installations. And I was putting them on aluminum and steel structures in the Connecticut River so that it looked like the tanks were floating on the surface. And then I realized the structures were really interesting and took them out of the water and put them on land, and that's kind of how it came to be.
This piece is outside at the mountain here, as all of the Sculpture Now sculptures are. How do the elements influence the piece? Do you prefer it remain pristine, or is the sort of dew and not exactly dirt, but, you know, pollen, is that fine? Is that part of the experience?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's really two parts. So how does it respond to the environment? So we have glass and water. It creates an optical experience, and it refracts and reflects light. And so anything around the piece, the grass, the trees, the beautiful formal gardens, the gorgeous house in the distance, all of those things you can see inside these tanks, refracted and reflected in different ways depending on where you're looking, the time of day, the angle of the sun, how close you are to the tank, or how far away you are. So those things all affect how the piece is seen. And that's an important part of this, is that it's not just a sculpture standing in space and all about the elements and the components of the sculpture, but everything around it becomes an essential part. You can't get away from it. It becomes a visual part. The second part of your question, in terms of super clean or not so super clean, I start with, you know, brand new material, the aluminum material. The tanks were cleaned very, very carefully. I stacked them all here, put the whole sculpture, put the lids on top, and it immediately starts to change. And so change, another way of putting it, is entropy. Everything goes from order to disorder in the natural world, or the physical world. This piece also speaks to that. So you mentioned pollen. Interesting you would mention that, because I came back a week later and the thing was covered in pollen. In fact, I got a call from Anne saying, your piece is covered in pollen. Do you want it to be that way? And I said, yes, I do. I want it to respond to the environment. And if pollen falling on it is part of that, that's fine. So then the rain comes down and the pollen is sitting on the top of the glass, but there's a little space around the top from the lid to the rest of the tank, because if I sealed it, expansion and contraction of water would cause it to burst. It would burst the seams. So there's a little teeny space under there that allows the water and the air to expand and contract. But also, the water level goes down, and there are these little droplets of water that are condensation droplets on the underside of the lid, which is a very important part of the piece. But back to the ecosystem, the rain would come down, and as it goes over the edge, capillary action draws that rainwater into the tank, so it changes the chemistry, but it's also drawing in the pollen. And so we now have 12 tanks that really have their own ecosystem. They've turned discolored a little bit. It has a different color. You still see a lot of the optical conditions and experiences and phenomenon, but it's kind of taking on the environment in that way.
David Teeple's piece is entitled 12 Cuboid Stack. Sculpture Now's 2017 outdoor exhibition Nexus is on view at the Mount in Lenox, Massachusetts through October 31st, and there will be an artist-guided tour on October 15th at 1:30 p.m. To learn more, visit sculpturenow.org. That link is posted along with pictures, these interviews, and links to the artist's websites at wamc.org/roundtable. I'm Sarah LaDuke, and you're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.